Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In this episode, we are beginning our journey through the W section of the Monster Manual. But before we do that, let's take a look at some listener mail. Now, in the last episode, I commented that I wasn't sure that vampires should be chaotic evil per se, since, I don't know, they're very rule-bound creatures, and that feels like, therefore, they ought to be lawful. Listener Mookie writes, "The line between lawful and chaotic has always been a bit wobbly, especially with monsters. Are orcs truly chaotic evil when they organize themselves into tribes and have leadership roles? Sure, the biggest and strongest lead everyone else follows isn't a very complicated hierarchy, but it is a hierarchy, and it seems to work fine for lawful evil devils. That aside, I think vampires work fine as chaotic evil. Their weaknesses aren't rules they have to follow, so much as limitations of their nature. A vampire can't cross running water because it's a vampire, not because it's honor-bound not to. Vampires are chaotic because of what they are, undead predators that stalk the night looking for people to consume and enthrall. They may dress themselves up as Victorian nobility and play at being genteel, but they're essentially supernatural serial killers and kidnappers. They aren't compatible with law and order very often." I mean, I think that's interesting. I think if you look at Dracula in London, Dracula in London is chaotic evil. But Dracula in Transylvania, which is how you're more likely to encounter a Dungeons & Dragons vampire, is lawful evil, right? I guess the question is it like there's a vampire creeping through this town, destabilizing the normal order of things, or is it the tyrannical rule of a monster is the normal order of things? And I think that vampire tyrants are probably as common in a Dungeons & Dragons game as vampire psychopaths, which, as Mookie says, I think reveals the way in which assigning a single alignment to a whole group of monsters, when there's no, like, cosmological reason for it, or even when there is, kind of reveals some of the limitations of the alignment system. Yeah, it's not perfect. But anyway, I think it's a fair point, and thanks for writing in, Mookie. Listener Steve offers some clarification on Umber, which I mentioned the other day, originally comes back in the Umber Hulk episode, comes from a word that means the earth of Umbria, a part of Italy, so that I didn't think that the word was related to Umbra, a shadow. He says, "According to Wikipedia and Pliny the Elder, the Umbrian people are thought the oldest in Italy. They are believed to have been called Umbri, here the people of the thunderstorm, after Greek ombros, thunderstorm, because they survived the deluge, literally, inundation of the lands by thunderstorms, imbribus." I mean, sure, I do think that there are a lot of these sort of folk etymologies. I don't know if that's true or if it's just something Pliny said. And finally, listener Stan has some theories about Umber Hulks. He says, "I'm writing to share a weird Umber Hulk theory. It can burrow through solid rock with its iron-hard claws, but this doesn't really make sense. Even if you're strong enough to tear rock apart, when you do, the rock chunks will take up more space than they did as a solid mass. You could burrow a little ways into a rock surface like this, but before you went very far, the tunnel would be so choked with boulders you'd be unable to move. It seems like the rock has to actually be destroyed somehow in order to tunnel like this. My pet theory is that the Umber Hulk has something of an elemental nature, and what's going on is that the majority of the rock is being transmuted into air. If this transmutation is by mass instead of volume, it might even help explain why there's so much fresh air in the Underdark. Perhaps Sverfneblin eco-terrorists might launch a Save the Umber Hulks campaign against marauding Umber Hulk murderers. I appreciate this theory, which is sort of, you know, which makes sense in a goofy kind of way, but I do think that starting to think about where all the breathable air in the Underdark comes from, that way madness lies." Anyway, thank you to all three of these listeners for writing in. I really appreciate hearing from people. And if you have sent an email or made a comment on one of the posts and I haven't read it, it's not because I didn't read it or enjoy it. It's because my organization of this segment is unbelievably slapdash. So let's move on to something that's been organized for me. That is to say, the W section of the Monster Manual. We start out with the wasp, giant. Wasps, giant are great. Wasps are horrible. I mean, there's something horrible about a wasp's nest. A giant one would be unspeakably awful. And there's something horrible about wasps. Because of the way they sting being different from bees, we see them as malevolent, whereas it's easy to see bees as friendly. You know, some people are frightened of bees, some people with good reason. I never used to like bees, but now I feel quite affectionate toward them, and, you know, if a bee gets trapped in my house, I just try to steer it back out because I know that it's lost and whatever, whereas if a wasp is in my house, I'm not saying burn the house down and move, but I'm not saying it's the top of my list of things to do, but it's on there. So the giant wasp is horrid, and it's doubly horrid because of the way in which it kills. So sometimes it just kills people for food, but sometimes it paralyzes you with its poisonous stinger, and then it lays its eggs in your paralyzed body, and then the wasp larvae emerge, and in D4 plus 1 days, they eat you up alive. That's horrific, and it really bridges the gap between wasps as, you know, naturalistic giant animal monster, like a giant beetle or whatever. Giant beetles are fun, they're not horrific, but these, just by taking a behavior that really exists in the animal world and bringing it up to human scale, are absolutely revolting and terrifying. Even the suggested method of killing them is horrifying, right? The idea is that wasp wings are so thin that if they're touched by fire at all, their wings will blaze up and they'll fall to the ground, unable to fly. Which, on the one hand, it serves the egg-laying swine right, but on the other hand, that's terrifying. That's terrifying. Anyway, wasps, comma, giant are fantastic. There was an old miniatures game, I think it was Chronopia, but it might have been Leviathan, that had swamp goblins who rode around on giant insects, and I think they might have had giant wasps. They also had giant dragonflies, I'm not sure. But little goblins, or kobolds, or whatever, riding around on the back of giant wasps would be nightmarish. Next up, we have the water weird. Water weirds are a little bit like, there are water elementals, and then there are water weirds, in the same way that there are various kinds of, like, rocky creatures that we'll get to later, like the Galabdur, or like the salamander is a type of fire elemental, or a being from the elemental plane of fire, even though it's not a fire elemental per se. The water weird is kind of interesting. It seems to be, the description in the monster manual itself is a little bit vague, and so we have to kind of infer from the water weird's behavior what it is. It emerges from a body of water, but it seems to, like, form its body out of that water. And it can infect a water elemental and take control over it, so it almost seems to be like a kind of consciousness that can be put into a body of water and turn that body of water into its body of water, if you see what I mean. And that's a very interesting idea. You know, we know that water elementals have bodies that are made out of water, but what if there's some kind of, you know, consciousness that can just animate water? What if that's what a water weird is? Anyway, I like the idea of a specific body of water, like the water in this fountain or the water in this pool is alive and can move around, rather than just, here is a creature made from water, but that is distinct from some other pond or lake or stream. So I feel like the water weird just has more character than a regular old water elemental, and has the additional gimmick that also makes it fun. Next on the list, we have another winner. It's the weasel, comma, giant. Weasels are great, aren't they? I mean, mustelids are great in general. It's sort of like, in the predatory mammal stakes, you got your big cats, and you got your big dogs. You know, you got wolves, and I guess it's mainly wolves. And then, of course, in big cats, you got lions, tigers, leopards, etc., but there's something special about the mustelids, about the weasels, badgers, wolverines. I think it's to do with their stumpy little legs. I think there's something very funny about fierce, aggressive predators with stumpy little legs. And I don't have a good reason for that. It helps that the fact that they're not that large gives them a reputation for ferocity. So, well, I don't know. But there's, for example, there is a species of weasel that we get here in Britain, and I believe they're found pretty much everywhere, called the least weasel. It's hard to really be frightened or angry at the least weasel. You know, it's so adorable. But at the same time, we do have this sense that they're quite fierce and very aggressive even relative to their small size, and that's true with the larger mustelids as well, like badgers and wolverines are not big, but they certainly have the sense of being aggressive and tough. For weasels, many of us have that image, weasels ripped my flesh. So giant weasels are in that state where we take the ferocity of this small animal and then you kind of scale it up to a big animal. Like, if you were attacked by a weasel in real life, it would be annoying because, you know, they can be quite fierce, but you'd be sort of like skipping around going, it's trying to bite me, get it away. Like, you wouldn't really be in fear for your life. But a big weasel, I don't remember, the weasel comma giant is not huge. It's still only size medium. So it's, you know, it's scaled up to kind of people size. It's not as big as a horse, which is size large. So it's just sort of like if a weasel were the size of a wolf. But a weasel the size of a wolf is quite a frightening prospect. And then there's a bit about domestication, which gives us the wonderful sense of like, oh, well, what if, you know, I mean, later editions of D&D, you know, made much of like halfling paladins riding around on the back of giant ferrets or whatever. And that's adorable. But also just the idea of, again, goblins riding around on the back of giant weasels would actually be quite horrible and sort of suitably goblin-like. The idea of them scuttling and scurrying over things is pretty cute. And if something is both cute and horrifying, then it's a good mount for goblins, right? So I think the weasel, comma, giant is pretty good. We think of weasels as fierce. We think of them as cunning, right? I mean, the expression to weasel out of something. So we think of them as clever, which is a nice thing in an animal enemy. You know, it's not like some animal enemies we think of as just kind of like fierce and aggressive, but, you know, they're dumb because they're animals. Whereas weasels, I think we think of as intelligent. And a lot of the time when you're dealing with an animal in a D&D game, it's very much like, what would this character do in a fairy tale or in a children's book? And we know what weasels would do in a children's book because, of course, it's weasels who are the bad guys in The Wind and the Willows. And we know that they would be awful. So that's the weasel, comma, giant. I think they're pretty good. I think they're versatile. I think people have feelings about weasels, which means that some of the work is done for you already. Finally, we have the whale. Now, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail about the whale entry, but it is quite interesting in that it doesn't have what a lot of other entries that cover multiple types of animal do, which is have a sub-entry for each one. It gives you a wide range of different behaviors and abilities for the whale. So the thing is 12 to 36 hit dice and does 1 to 5d8 damage. Like, that's a pretty big variation. Whereas if you went back and looked at, you know, the spider. The spiders have a range of different abilities, but they're subdivided into spider types. And there isn't even the distinction between, you know, the carnivorous species and the not carnivorous species. There's rules for how they can, you know, bash in your whale boat with their tail flukes. Basically, there's a whole whaling subgame in here. You know, how much is this ambergris gonna sell for? You know, will this whale smash our boat to flinders with his tail flukes, etc.? Will it swallow us like in Pinocchio? Will there be treasure inside its tummy when it does swallow us? Again, hard to imagine most whale species swallowing a human without crushing the human to bits with their teeth first, since it's very hard to imagine a baleen whale swallowing a human at all, because you'd have to pass through the sieve of the baleen, wouldn't you? Little do I know about baleen whale feeding, something that I didn't think I was ever going to say in this Dungeons & Dragons Monsters podcast, but never mind. So whales are okay, but the key point here is just how they demonstrate the huge range of possible applications that the designers foresaw this book being used for. There's the mechanical kernel of a Moby Dick campaign in here. And I think almost any game designed in the modern day would think, well, Moby Dick is going to be so far outside our core competence that we're just not going to bother with it, right? Unless it was, you know, some Moby Dick game being kickstarted. And that is a product of, you know, 40-whatever years of a marketplace in which role-playing games have to some degree become increasingly specialized. But D&D at the time was, you know, even though this was starting to change already by the late 70s, certainly wanted to think of itself as the role-playing game. And if you wanted to do the Moby Dick game, or perhaps more accurately, if that idea just sort of occurred to Gary Gygax while he was writing the entry on whales, then Moby Dick game there was going to be. And I think that's a certain amount to be said for that. I mean, I'm never going to use it. I'm not going to run a whaling game, and I think most people in 2018 wouldn't either. But it's just interesting to see that it's in there. Okay, so with the whale out of the way, next time we're going to be looking at the wight, the will-o'-the-wisp, the Windwalker, and the Wolf. So please join me for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.